Hey everybody, and welcome to another deep dive. This time we are heading over to Spain, to the Basque Country, to take a look at the health habits of young people there.
That's right, and we've got some great research to help us with this deep dive.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about the research that we're looking at today.
Well, today's deep dive is going to be led by the work of Maite Garagardibil, a professor of psychology at the University of the Basque Country, and she has done a bunch of research looking at adolescents and young adults between 2008 and 2016, focusing specifically on their health and well-being.
So like a pretty good time span there to give us a good snapshot of what's going on.
Exactly, yeah.
That's so interesting because I feel like when we think about young people, we think about health, you know, all that youthful energy.
Right.
And like that sort of invincibility you feel when you're younger.
Yeah. You would think they'd be the healthiest.
Exactly. But her findings, I mean, they paint kind of a different picture, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of a paradox because a lot of these young people believe they're healthy. But when you look at their actual behaviors, there's kind of a mismatch.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And that's what Garagardibil's research really highlights is this gap between perception and reality, especially when you start comparing how young men and women view their health, and also how those perceptions differ between adolescents and young adults.
Huh. So are you saying like there's some gender differences or even like age differences in how they're perceiving their own health?
Exactly. Yeah. So for example, you know, men often report having healthier habits than women, and adolescents tend to think they're healthier than young adults do.
So fascinating. It makes you wonder, is it that their habits are actually different? Or is it just how they're perceiving them and reporting on them?
That's the big question, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, let's get into some of those habits then. And like, you know, what's she looking at specifically with these habits?
So one of the things that Garagardibil focuses on that I think is really compelling is risk behaviors. And she found that there's a concerning trend where these risk behaviors tend to cluster together.
Oh, what does that mean, cluster?
So, you know, if a teen starts smoking, they might also be more likely to, you know, experiment with alcohol or engage in risky sexual behavior.
So they're kind of all happening at the same time.
Yeah, it's almost like one risky choice opens the door for others. And so that's kind of a worrying trend to see.
Yeah. I mean, why is that happening? Do you think is it social pressure? Is this just that kind of like rebellious phase that teenagers go through?
It's probably a mix of things.
Yeah.
You know, you can't discount peer groups. Teenagers are very much attuned to social dynamics and, you know, they want to fit in. They want to be like their peers.
Totally.
But there's also, you know, it's adolescence. It's a time of exploration and risk taking. It's a time of figuring out boundaries, testing limits, and sometimes, you know, making choices without fully understanding the consequences.
Right. And it speaks to the importance of like having these conversations with young people and, yeah, you know, helping them understand like, hey, these are the choices that you're making.
Yep.
These could be the consequences, but like not in a way that's, you know, preachy or you're talking down to them or anything, but just like letting them know, like, this is the reality of the situation.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've talked about these risk behaviors, but let's look at another aspect of her research, which is really fascinating to me. And that's the connection between mental well-being and these healthy habits.
Right. And this is where Garagardibil's research gets really interesting because she found this really strong correlation between positive mental health and making healthy lifestyle choices. So young people who reported, you know, higher levels of well-being, fewer psychological symptoms, they were much more likely to engage in healthy behaviors.
So like, does that mean healthy habits lead to better mental well-being, or is it the other way around? You know, it's like the chicken or the egg.
That's a great question. And you know, it's probably not a simple answer. It's probably a little bit of both.
Yeah. Like a feedback loop.
You know, like a reciprocal relationship. You know, if you feel good mentally, you might be more motivated to take care of your physical health. And then taking care of your physical health can make you feel better mentally.
That makes sense, yeah.
So it's this really, you know, complex interplay.
And this kind of leads us to another really interesting part of Garagardibil's research, and that is eating habits, body image, and the differences that she saw between young men and women.
Right. And her work really sheds light on some important gender differences in this area. For example, she found that girls, you know, they generally report having healthier eating habits than boys, but they also experience much higher levels of body dissatisfaction. They're more prone to dieting and they express more negative emotions like anger and distrust.
That's so interesting because it's almost like this paradox where they're making healthier food choices, but they're not necessarily feeling good about themselves.
Right. And I think, you know, we can't ignore the immense societal pressure that's on girls to conform to certain body ideals. You know, think about the media advertising, even just social interactions. All of those things contribute to creating this very narrow definition of beauty that can be really damaging.
Absolutely. And this leads us to like this really important part of her research, which is eating disorders, and specifically the risk factors that she identified.
Right. And so she goes beyond just those general trends and really starts to dig into the specific variables that might predict someone's risk of developing an eating disorder.
Okay.
So, for example, you know, for boys, a key predictor of an obsession with thinness was perceiving themselves as having a high BMI and also having that kind of personality trait of being impulsive.
So it's not just about body image, it's also like their personality traits and how that might play into it.
Exactly.
What about girls then?
For girls, it was a little more complex. So, you know, things like low self-esteem, perceiving themselves as overweight, even if they weren't, and also, you know, focusing on body image as the main reason for dieting, and then just overall lower levels of happiness were all strong predictors of an obsession with thinness.
Yeah, it's so sad because you can see how all of these things kind of intertwine and, you know, girls can be very susceptible to these pressures.
Right.
But let's unpack that a little bit more. What about other eating disorders like bulimia? Does she find similar gender differences in those risk factors?
Yeah, she did so with bulimia. She found that for boys, the major predictors were perceiving themselves as overweight, having a high level of what's called interoceptive awareness, meaning they're very tuned into internal bodily sensations and also consuming a lot of unhealthy foods.
Hold on, wait, could you explain interoceptive awareness a little more?
Yeah, so that basically means being very sensitive to, you know, internal sensations like hunger, fullness, heartbeat, even emotions. So it's kind of like having this heightened awareness of what's going on inside your body.
So that's interesting because it's almost like they're so aware of these internal cues and maybe they're not satisfied with their weight, that might lead to bulimia.
Exactly.
What about for girls?
So interestingly, for girls, the strongest predictors of bulimia were high levels of perfectionism and once again, that impulsivity.
Wow, that is so interesting because it's showing that, like, even though both genders can experience this disorder, the underlying reasons or like those psychological drivers might be really different.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons I think Garagordabile's research is so valuable because it helps us move beyond just these general statements about eating disorders and really look at, you know, the nuances based on gender and individual predispositions.
Right. So we've talked about obsession with thinness, bulimia. Now, what about just general body dissatisfaction? I feel like that's pretty common, you know?
It is, and it's not
It
necessarily.
doesn't always lead to an eating disorder, but like it's still an issue.
Exactly. And she found some specific predictors for that too. So for boys, it was a combination of perceiving themselves as having a high BMI, struggling with anxiety, focusing on their body image as a reason for dieting, and once again, that tendency towards impulsivity.
So it's interesting because we're seeing that impulsivity pop up quite a bit, particularly for the boys.
Right. And it'd be interesting to explore that further, why that might be such a recurring factor. You know, maybe boys are just more prone to acting on their impulses without really thinking about the long-term consequences.
Yeah, that's a good point. What about girls?
So for girls, the picture was similar in some ways, but also distinct. So perceiving themselves as overweight, having low self-esteem, being shorter than average, striving for perfection, and yes, you guessed it, that impulsivity, again, were all strongly associated with body dissatisfaction.
So we are seeing some overlap, but then also some key differences.
Exactly. And that's why this research is so helpful because it gives us these really specific insights that can help with early intervention and targeted prevention strategies. So rather than just saying, oh, you know, eating disorders are a problem, it's like, well, what are the specific things that we can look for and how can we tailor our approaches to different groups?
It helps us understand like the psychology of it all, and like you were saying, those social factors, maybe even some biological factors that are playing into it.
Right. It's really complex.
But before we get too far down that road, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll explore how Gerard Gordabile's research can be applied to create some real-world solutions.
Sounds good. Yeah, it really is fascinating how Gerard Gordabile's research just gives us this like granular view of these issues. And you know, like you said, it's not just about understanding the problems. It's about using that understanding to actually help, you know, young people develop a healthier relationship with their bodies and themselves.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a good place to start is to kind of go back to that disconnect that we talked about earlier between perceived health and actual habits. You know, it's almost like some of these young people are living in a bubble, thinking they're healthy, while engaging in behaviors that maybe suggest otherwise.
Yeah, and that disconnect really is a key theme throughout Gar Gordobiel's work. You know, for example, she found that men tend to, you know, perceive their health more positively than women do, and adolescents as a group tend to have a rosier outlook on their health compared to young adults.
Okay, so that makes me think, is it maybe tied to societal expectations? You know, like, is there less pressure on men to kind of adhere to certain health standards, or are they just, you know, less likely to admit that they have unhealthy habits?
It's definitely possible, you know, and there's also, you know, that element of social desirability bias to consider people, especially young people, might be hesitant to disclose behaviors that they think are frowned upon or considered unhealthy. You know, it's all about fitting in and projecting a certain image.
Right. And it really just emphasizes, like, the importance of creating these safe spaces where young people can talk openly and honestly about their health without feeling judged. You know?
Absolutely.
But let's shift gears a little bit and talk about some other areas that she looked at in her research. I know we've been talking a lot about eating disorders, but she also kind of touches on broader aspects of youth health, like sleep and substance use and sexual health.
Yeah.
So did her research kind of shed any light on these areas as well?
You're right. You know, it's important to look at the whole picture. And while those weren't the sole focus of her research, they're definitely kind of woven into the fabric of her findings. You know, for example, when we're talking about, you know, mental well-being and its link to healthy habits, we can't forget about sleep.
Oh my gosh, sleep is so important.
It is so critical.
And it's like the first thing to go when you're stressed or, you know, just feeling overwhelmed. But it is so important.
It is, especially, you know, during those really crucial developmental years of adolescence and young adulthood. You know, sleep deprivation can actually exacerbate a lot of the issues that we've been discussing, from mental health problems to, you know, unhealthy eating habits to engaging in risky behaviors.
Yeah, it's like this domino effect. You know, when you're sleep deprived, your decision making goes downhill, you get more irritable, you're more impulsive, you crave those sugary, fatty foods for a quick energy boost. And it's just like a recipe for unhealthy choices.
Exactly. And so, you know, even though Gary Gordobiel's research didn't like specifically focus on sleep habits in the Basque Country, you know, it's probably safe to assume that prioritizing sleep plays a really important role in just overall well-being for young people.
Yeah. And this is something that, you know, parents, educators, and even policymakers need to really keep in mind. You know, creating environments that actually support healthy sleep habits is just as important as promoting healthy eating and exercise.
Absolutely. We often underestimate the power of just a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
You know, and now you mentioned substance use and sexual health. These are obviously sensitive topics.
Yeah.
But they're really important to talk about when we're thinking about youth health.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So did her research shed any light on these areas?
You know, while these weren't the primary focus of her work, it is important to remember that they don't exist in isolation. You know, substance use and sexual health, they're often intertwined with all the other issues that we've been discussing.
Right. So like if a young person is dealing with anxiety or depression, they might be more likely to turn to drugs or alcohol as a coping mechanism.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to address those underlying mental health issues and to provide young people with healthy coping strategies.
Right.
You know, and similarly, when we're talking about body image and societal pressures, we can't ignore how those might influence a young person's sexual experiences and the choices that they make.
It's all connected.
It really is.
Yeah. And it really emphasizes the need for like a holistic approach to youth health, one that kind of acknowledges the complexity of these issues and just approaches them with sensitivity and understanding.
I completely agree. It's not about offering these simple solutions or placing blame. It's about creating an environment where young people feel supported, informed, and empowered to actually make choices that promote their well-being.
Yeah, and to actually go back to Gary Gordobiel's findings for a second, you know, we were talking earlier about this clustering of risk factors, how one unhealthy behavior can lead to another.
Mm-hmm.
Did her research kind of offer any insights into why this might be happening?
That's a great question. And while she didn't like explicitly delve into the why of clustering, you know, we can kind of speculate based on her findings and what we know about adolescent psychology. You know, one possible explanation is just the social aspect. Teenagers are so attuned to their peers.
Right.
And the need to fit in can be really overwhelming.
So if their friends are all experimenting with drugs or alcohol, they're going to feel pressured to kind of join in, even if they're not totally comfortable with it.
Exactly. You know, it's about social acceptance, belonging, proving that you're cool or grown up. But there's also that element of risk taking that's just inherent to adolescence.
Right. Testing boundaries, pushing limits, and sometimes making those choices without fully grasping what those consequences could be.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, open communication and education are so vital. It's not about scaring young people or lecturing them. It's about having these honest conversations, providing accurate information, and helping them develop those critical thinking skills to make informed decisions.
Right. And I think a really crucial part of this conversation is acknowledging the role of technology, and especially social media.
Oh, absolutely.
In shaping, you know, young people's perceptions and behaviors. Did Gary Gordabiel touch upon that at all in her research?
So her research actually predates the explosion of social media as we know it today. But, you know, we can't ignore its influence, these platforms, you know, with their curated feeds and this constant pursuit of likes and validation. They really amplify the pressures that Gary Gordabiel identifies as those risk factors for body dissatisfaction, eating disorders, even substance use.
Yeah, it's like a double-edged sword. On one hand, it can be really great for connecting with people and creating these communities and accessing information. But then on the other hand, it can really fuel those insecurities and distort perceptions and just create these really unrealistic expectations.
Exactly. It's a really complex issue, and it requires, you know, careful navigation. We need to be equipping young people with the tools to critically evaluate the information that they're seeing online and to develop that healthy sense of self-worth that's not solely based on external validation.
Right. So it's not just about, you know, telling them to stay off social media. It's about giving them those tools to actually navigate it in a healthy way. And I think that kind of leads us to the final thought I want to leave our listeners with today. You know, Gary Gordabiel's research gives us this really deep understanding of the challenges the young people are facing. But it's really up to each of us to apply those insights in our own lives and communities.
Yeah. That's a great point. It's not just about understanding the research. It's about turning that knowledge into action.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really about giving them the tools to, you know, make those healthy choices and to build that resilience.
Right.
But before we wrap up today, I want to kind of circle back to something you said earlier, which is the role of parents, educators, and communities in supporting youth health. What can they actually do to make a difference?
Well, you know, Gary Gordabiel's research kind of gives us this roadmap and suggests that it's not about one magic solution. It's about this multi-pronged approach. And I think a good starting point is communication, you know, creating these environments where young people feel comfortable actually talking about their struggles, whether it's body image, mental health, substance use, you know, anything that they're going through.
It's like building that trust so they feel safe to open up.
Exactly. It's about adults being approachable, non-judgmental, really listening to them and offering support without dismissing their concerns.
Right.
And beyond that, open communication education plays a huge role. You know, we need comprehensive sex education that goes beyond the basics and actually talks about healthy relationships, consent respecting boundaries.
Yeah. And it's not just sex ed. It's also like equipping them with those media literacy skills.
Absolutely.
So they can actually like critically evaluate what they're seeing, especially online.
You got to, you know, help them recognize those unrealistic beauty standards, understand how these algorithms work, and develop that healthy skepticism towards that curated perfection that they see online.
Right, because it's not real life.
Exactly. And education doesn't stop there. You know, we need to equip them with tools to manage stress, build resilience, cope with difficult emotions in healthy ways.
So like things like mindfulness or, you know, relaxation techniques or even creative outlets.
Absolutely. Give them a toolbox of strategies to deal with the ups and downs of life.
Yeah, because let's be real, life is full of ups and downs.
It is.
And, you know, one thing that I think is so important is promoting positive role models.
Yes.
You know, people who are, you know, showing diverse body types, celebrating achievements that go beyond just physical appearance and, you know, people who are really prioritizing their well-being over trying to fit into this mold.
Exactly. It's about shifting the narrative and expanding that definition of what it means to be healthy, successful, worthy.
I love that.
You know, and I think it all comes down to creating this culture where young people feel valued, supported, and empowered to make choices that are good for them.
Yeah, creating a culture of well-being.
Exactly.
You know, and not telling them what to do, but really giving them the information, the skills, the support they need to make those informed decisions for themselves.
Well said. I think that's a great place to leave it.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into youth health habits in the Basque Country. We hope you found it informative and thought-provoking and maybe even inspiring.
It was my pleasure.
And to all our listeners out there, you know, keep this conversation going. Talk to your friends, your family, the young people in your life. Share what you've learned. And let's work together to create a world where young people can thrive. Until next time, keep diving deep.